we're studying economic and social mobility. If you take a high performing student, a student that is, kind of in the top quartile of kids within a school, especially from a low income neighborhood, their outcomes over time don't necessarily mean that they will be within like the top earners.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis. In this episode, we zoom out a little to talk about what happens after multilingual learners and other students from marginalized communities leave K-12 schools and what we can do to make sure they are equipped to reach their highest aspirations. What does the data say about economic and social mobility of students from historically marginalized communities? How can we help improve outcomes and long-term trajectories of students from those communities, including multilingual learners? And how can we leverage the linguistics and cultural assets multilingual learners bring to better our communities while simultaneously working to close wealth gaps? We discuss these questions and much more with David Nungaray. David is the bilingual consulting partner at TNTP. Currently, he oversees partnerships in Alaska, California, Nevada, and Texas. He also supports TNTP's multilingual strategy across the country. David has led teams focused on partnering with districts through strategic planning, biliteracy visioning and implementation, dual language supports, stakeholder and family engagement, high impact tutoring, learning acceleration, and statewide high quality instructional materials adoption. Prior to his time at TNTP, David served as the principal of one of the flagship dual-language schools in San Antonio ISD. He first began his career as a dual-language teacher and has led work in bilingual education for over a decade. As a son of immigrants, native Spanish speaker, and a first-generation college graduate, David is passionate about educational equity and ensuring school systems best meet the needs of all learners. David is also an alum of Teach for America. He serves on multiple nonprofit boards focused on education, and he holds his master's in school leadership from Trinity University, where he has served as an adjunct professor in multilingual education, school leadership, and special education. He also recently co-authored a chapter in Breaking Down the Monolingual Wall that speaks to essential shifts needed in leadership to support multilingual learners. In short, David Nungaray is well positioned to speak with us about this important topic. And as always, I hope you enjoy this episode of Highest Aspirations. David Nungaray, thank you so much for joining us on Highest Aspirations.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Steve. Good to see you.
Yeah, for sure. You're one of those people. I feel like I say this all the time, but you're one of those people who we've talked at many conferences and panels online and in person. And I'm really excited to finally have you on. We talked a lot about possible topics, and there's so much that you, I feel like, know about and bring to the table. I think we picked a good one here, so I'm excited.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's definitely one that I've been thinking a lot about. It's been top of mind, both like personally and professionally, so I'm excited for us to dig in.
I love that combination. So the personal and professional combination. So let's dive in. So before we take kind of a deep dive into economic and social mobility for kids from historically marginalized communities, let's ground the conversation in an infographic that you shared with me. It was from OELA, the Office of English Language Acquisition, a while back. And it outlines the benefits of multilingualism by breaking them down into these four general categories. And I would urge people to look at it, although I just Googled it to like refresh my memory and I couldn't find it. So it's not easy to find. We'll link to it here. But anyway, the four categories are sociocultural, cognitive, educational, and economic. We'll probably touch on all of them throughout the course of this conversation, but let's focus on economic benefits for now. Could you break down that kind of economic piece for the sake of people who may not have the graphic, and the extent to which multilingual learners we serve are kind of benefiting from it and contributing to it?
Yeah. Well, I can say that I've personally benefited from it, right? Like when I reflect on the long trajectory of both my parents coming to this country, literally my dad came here with one shirt and one pair of shorts. And even last night as we were having dinner, I was talking to him about his own economic, progression and mobility within this country as an immigrant, now naturalized citizen. Obviously, our multilingual community is not a monolith. There's a lot of complexity and diversity. And to your point, I think most people listening to this will have heard about the benefits of social, cultural, cognitive, and educational benefits. So I'm glad that we're getting to dig in here on economics. Specifically, when we think about, the OELA infographic, which I tell Montserrat Garibay, the deputy director of OELA, This is one of my favorite infographics to share. It really is because it does touch on this new frontier of the economic opportunity that exists. Now, economic opportunity, is not given. It's not something that will just happen by chance. And it's why at TNTP, we've spent so much time and effort over the last year and a half since our new CEO, Dr. Taquilla Browning, became the CEO, to really think about what this means for our multilingual communities. So specifically, we're talking about greater opportunities, both in public and private sectors, right? When I think about my multilingualism, bilingualism within the nonprofit sector, for example, I'm able to reach different communities, and oftentimes in job postings, you'll see bilingual preferred or Spanish, as part of the requirement. And so giving our kids access to multilingualism, giving them access to dual language programs in particular, also gives us an opportunity for higher earning potential, right? Oftentimes, these roles, these responsibilities, are you're seeing in the workforce more and more people pay for that skill set. And when I think about specifically, OLA calls out job opportunities within the federal government, right? And some of these critical languages like Arabic, Urdu, Farsi, Russian, there's just so many languages that we're seeing in our schools. And school systems mobilize around ensuring that kids have access to a dual language program in those languages.
So it's great that you outlined all that, and I feel like it's such a tricky subject because what is outlined on there are all the opportunities that are available and the sort of benefits of multilingualism. Yet we're still seeing a racial wealth gap, and so it's a little bit. I often wonder, when are we going to sort of see those things really play out in the world after. These kids that were many people who are listening right now are working with them in K-12. When are these going to pan out? When are we going to really see the data? And so I'm wondering, like, think of that. We'll get into that in a little bit. Not necessarily the data, but just the trends. What trends or movement are we seeing right now on that racial wealth gap? I mean, has it changed much over time? Are we moving in the right direction?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that we dug into in our initial phase of the research around economic and social mobility within our organization. Obviously, just Google racial wealth gap and you're going to see a lot of facts and figures
Yeah, I
related to
did.
specifically,
It was confusing.
it's pretty striking between specifically Black households and white households. I mean, I think when I looked at data there, it was really evident that the wealth gaps are not closing. To your point from earlier, a lot of that obviously relates to homeownership. Homeownership plays a huge role in that, but so does the types of jobs that our kids and communities have access to within their communities. And so oftentimes, and there was a report from McKinsey that I saw specifically related to the Latino wealth gap. I mean, we see also wage gaps, right, between men and women. That's another big topic of conversation within this space. But when we think about the impact of poverty, and we saw some work from the Opportunity Atlas in particular, right, where like a zip code can really determine the outcomes for kids, and breaking from poverty is not something that our system is good at doing. And there's some, things, for example, we're in San Antonio, the community that I used to live in for a long time, where I did a lot of my work. You're seeing greater access to mobility through things like, community college, the Alamo Promise, that gives kids an opportunity. I had $32,000 in student loan debt when I graduated from college, not including the $50,000 that my dad took in parent loans. And so when you think about the opportunity for someone like me to experience economic mobility, I don't have many of our kids like me don't have the same head start that other communities have, where my conversations at home were, how do we make sure that, for example, when my dad got laid off, that we were mindful of how much food we were eating or the types of places we could choose to live in. Other communities, other conversations are around like, how do we start a 529 for kids? I didn't even know what a 529 was until I grew up and studied more about finances. So to the question, are we seeing improvements? Yes, we are. Are they to the scale that we need to really close racial wealth gaps? Not enough. And so much of the interplay with education, right? TNTP's focus on academic and talent initiatives related to consulting, whether it's work with the science of teaching reading, right, as an important part, or high quality instructional materials. Those are all things that really aim to improve opportunity for our children. But I think we've realized, and Tukula, Dr. Brownie, at the helm of our organization, has done an incredible job of opening our eyes, definitely opening my eyes, especially when we think about what this means within multilingual communities that, as I mentioned earlier, are not a monolith, but even, more deeply when we think about the fact that 75% of kids that are speak a language other than English are Spanish-speaking kids. So by and large, we're talking about Latino, Latinx, Latin, Spanish-speaking kids. That doesn't mean that we don't attend to the other 25% of kids and communities and racial, ethnic backgrounds. But even within the Black community, which we know dialect comes up as a huge piece of educating children, those are things that we're attending to within our organization. But you and I both know we've got a lot of work to do ahead of us related to this topic.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that work, I don't want to say it starts with, but a lot of it is related to what you mentioned earlier, this idea of the zip code and the zip code determining sort of or having a very strong level of influence over sort of earnings potential, et cetera. And that's something that, I've thought a lot about when it comes to education, having worked in two very different districts with very different zip codes. Obviously the zip codes are different, but the opportunities in those districts were different. And my question is, in those zip codes where you have it's their low income schools, you have a lot of students who are from marginalized communities, what are we, is the sort of the movement, if any, in the racial wealth gap and the long-term trajectories of those students, is that related? Are we seeing the trajectories of students from low-income schools improving, or is that the same as well?
Yeah, I would say that's still a work in progress, right? And I think about the access to a strong instruction and a strong education should be something that is moving more of our kids. But and remember some of the early research we looked at when we were studying economic and social mobility. If you take a high performing student, a student that is, kind of in the top quartile of kids within a school, especially from a low-income neighborhood, their outcomes over time don't necessarily mean that they will be within like the top earners. And so that really speaks to even with a greater access to opportunity, and making sure that kids have a strong academic background, that does not necessarily equate to a student being able to move. And there's a lot of factors for that, right? So for example, for people like myself, my friends, we have to help out at home. There are responsibilities that we have that are complex and nuanced within our cultures, within our communities. There's also access, and I've been really passionate about financial literacy and literacies, right? There's what we call the funds of knowledge, right? And there's many social, navigational capitals that my parents gave me, but there was also a lack of financial knowledge that I had from my own schooling experience. So even if I was, which I was, like in the top quartile of my school, it's taken me a lot, and I'm sort of like the oddball or the outlier, probably within the data. Most kids like me were not on the same kind of trajectory, despite the academic ability and the academic access and opportunity.
I can relate to that in some ways, although I definitely recognize my privilege having grown up in sort of a white middle class school community and school district that was in a zip code that was sort of known for, I guess, academic progress, and we did pretty well from there. But my father was an immigrant from Greece, had to drop out of high school. He was drafted to go and fight in Vietnam, and then came back and was able to, through a variety of ways, not the least of which were apprenticeship programs at places like General Electric, able to like have a middle class family and do everything that he needed to do to support his family. But one thing that he always sort of talked about, and I would stop short of saying he preached, but it was pretty close, was this idea that schools, he didn't understand why schools did not have programs for financial literacy. And he was very frustrated at the fact that when we were going to college, my brother and I, we didn't really understand what we were signing up for when we were taking out student loans that we needed to take out. In a similar situation as you, I had a fair amount of college debt coming out of school, but my parents paid for what they could. And then we had really no idea about this whole idea of retirement or much less 529 plans for our own children. I figured it out along the way. But that seems to have been a frustration for a long time. I've been now out of schools teaching for about 8 years, 9 years, actually. But I taught high school, and in both districts that I taught, I have to say, other than like the sort of rare project that somebody would do in a math class or something that was mostly actually like an advanced level math class, I didn't see too much on financial literacy. So my question there is have you, I keep asking, has this changed? Is this changing? Do you see, so let me ask a different question. Do you see examples of that happening anywhere? What
Yeah,
does it
there's one
look
of,
like, and how is it, how can it be successful?
yeah, there's a good friend of mine who I met in the education space. He actually works for Broadway Bank. His name is Jacob Cavazos. And I've seen his work and definitely set up some time to talk with him to, about what he was doing. He started off a fin prep program with a local high school, where the bank actually helps support this sort of financial literacy work. You know, to your point, I think the main thing I learned when I was a kid was how to sign my name on a check. That's like, if I could tell you like the most like salient memory I have related to financial literacy was like, here's how you sign your name on a check. Here's how you write out, you know, like I remember learning about checks. Not to say it's not important.
I remember cashing the checks that I remember the reward for working, but that's about it.
Yeah, but Jacob, you know, is teaching kids about careers in the field of finance, which, you know, at TNTP, we definitely talk about social capital, meaning like kids have the mentors and the adults around them to help them navigate their kind of life. The other thing we talk about is career-connected learning. And I think, you know, the work that he's doing does help kids connect to the kinds of jobs. So they have like speakers that come in and speak to the students. Plus, they're learning about things like the stock market. Like if you would have said to me, you know, you're going to have your 403b invested in the S&P 500, you're speaking a completely
Yep.
different language to me,
Talk about
right?
academic vocabulary, academic language.
Totally. And what it actually means, right? And so, you know, that's a huge, huge part. I think, you know, most of us understand maybe even coming out of college or even coming out of high school, like you need a budget. Right? Or you need to, you know, not spend more than you make because, you know, debt and credit cards are not fun. But I would say, you know, specifically when we think about examples, I would say that there are some good practices coming out of the work that he's doing. And then again, within the city of San Antonio, there's the Center for Applied Sciences and Technology, the CAS Schools Network. I really enjoy what they're doing. You know, they have a CAS Med, which is a school focused on medical fields, and they have a dual language program at that school, right? Which really taps into the
Amazing.
need we see in nursing or being doctors to really support multilingual communities. They also have CAS Tech, which is a school that focuses on getting kids into like high-paying jobs. And I think that's a huge game changer. Also, most recently, one of my colleagues at work brought up the work being done in Anaheim High School District. I just moved back to California, but I went to Anaheim schools, and it's been interesting to really think about the superintendent there and the work that he and his team have done to really turn around. I'm still learning about that work, and it's definitely, I think, a place where we want to, you know, dig into to see what are they doing differently and how are they connecting schooling to career trajectories for
Yeah.
higher paying jobs. And so I would feel like, you know, we're like on this cusp or on this precipice of like really seeing strong examples to your question. Jacob Cavazos, you know, work with Broadway Bank being one of them, the work in CAS schools being another. And then, you know, I'm excited to learn more about Anaheim, which is the district that I graduated from.
Yeah.
And so it's fun to come back to California and be like, oh, they're actually creating engines for economic mobility. And the last example I'll share, which is sort of new and emerging too, is a friend of mine who I actually went to college with. You know, I'm a Latino man, he's a Black man, and we both joined Teach for America and went in top, but we both stayed in the field of education for the last 13, almost 14 years. And he has this study that he's running with a couple of sites in New Orleans, where they're giving kids income. They're giving kids, I think it's $50 a week, and they're running this whole experiment on like what does it look like for kids to get guaranteed income and what kinds of things are they doing with it. I mean, it's like a whole new way of thinking. And I think that the city of New Orleans, he mentioned, invested like $1 million into the study to really see what does it look like for kids to be able to manage money. I mean, my first job was when I was 16, and I remember getting a paycheck and feeling like the thrill of like finally having a paycheck, but probably not knowing really what to do with it, manage it well.
100%. You just gave four great examples on a question that I should tell everybody we had. I did not prepare for that. Was a complete curveball. So thank you very much. I am curious though now to take it even more down a rabbit hole. Who is, and I may be putting you on the spot, you may not know who here, but who's the superintendent at Anaheim?
Michael Matsuda, and
That's what I thought.
so he wrote a book that a colleague shared with me. I want to dig into that, but then I just started like reading into what he was doing, what his team was doing, and then I was at Kabe a few weeks ago, and I finally got to at least introduce myself to him. But knowing now how proximate I am, and I'm excited about that work, but I just think we're on the cusp of like really learning, and they're doing some interesting work around AI, which is like a whole topic, I think, probably for a different one. But I would say, the work that they're doing and that we probably need to do as systems to help kids get access to those types of programs. I mean, when we think about language learning, right? Like literacies, like there is literally like a we need to learn English, for example, or we're learning another target language like English or Spanish or Mandarin. Or Korean, these all tie back to that infographic, right? But there's new languages we're going to need to learn, including in AI. I think the more that our schools, where kids who are furthest from opportunity get access to that kind of content, is going to make a big difference for higher paying waging jobs. We talk a lot about like the fact that there's facts and figures on this, but like there are so many jobs that we don't even know are going to be needed that we need to start preparing our kids for, and it's really why this push for economic and social mobility is so huge for us as an organization, and why academics and talent will continue to be a part of the work that people see TNCP do, but we're continuing to evolve into these spaces around social capital, and career connected learning because it is where we need to head as a system.
And it's much, and it's so needed and so necessary, and the paradigms need to shift. It's really difficult to do within the structure of what education is to make those changes. The reason I asked you about the superintendent of Anaheim is because we had a conversation, he and I, it was probably over a year ago now. I met someone from his team, and we had talked about doing a podcast on a very similar topic on the work that they're doing there to kind of put examples out there. And I did a lot of research, but we never made it. We never closed the loop. And I know he's really, really busy, so I didn't want to push too hard. But I was not at Cave last week. This year, I couldn't make it, but that would have been a good opportunity. Maybe, well, you jog my memory. Maybe we'll more to come on that. But what they have a phenomenal team there, and the work they're doing, just I just scraped the surface of it, but phenomenal. And right to your point of doing things really that are exemplary and sort of pioneering. And it's all about the philosophy and that paradigm shift, which I think is.
And connected to dual language programs, right? So I think that's part of the beauty of it is you're seeing that blend between the kinds of career connected learning that we need more systems to engage with, but also focusing on multilingualism as an asset, and really speaking the promise of that infographic into existence, which is what we need more systems design around. And it's going to take a lot of coalition building. I mean, that's one thing that we're very clear on, like TNTP, myself, like we're going into this thing, like we have all the answers, but actually we have a lot more. Like if you can't hear it just in this podcast, right? Like we've done some learning, we have more learning to do. And there's just a lot of opportunity for innovation within the space that I'm excited to be a part of, especially as it connects to multilingualism as an asset. So that's a big deal.
So I think I was going to ask you a question, but I won't now because I think we've come full circle on that. We started with the OLS benefits of multilingual learners or multilingualism infographic, and one of the tension points there is it talks about all these assets, but what's it really going to take to translate those assets into the mobility that we're talking about? And you I think we could skip it, but well, we didn't skip it because we already talked about it. You talked about a lot of the examples of how it's happening and what is needed to continue, and that's that coalition building. You all are doing phenomenal work. I mean, we've collaborated with you before, and it's always wonderful. So really appreciate the continued collaboration. Let's zoom out a little bit to something that you said when we last talked that I don't know, it may sound a little cliche, but coming from you, it didn't sound cliche at all because it was full of context that you had shared before. You said the American dream has evolved. So I'm not going to lead that in any way except to say, tell us more about that and how it applies to this topic.
Man, I get really passionate when we talk about the
Bring it.
American
Bring the passion.
as a whole. Obviously, as a son of immigrants, I have to think about the promise that my parents must have felt. My mom, for example, as a, teenage pregnant woman who said, my opportunities in this country were not great. Like she went to schooling until about fourth grade. My dad had a ton of potential as well, but didn't really ever get to live that out in the way he probably would have wished he had. And so myself, my sisters, my cousins, we were all, like the promise of what was possible when you came to America. In many ways, that dream still feels very alive, but the realities of it, I think, have evolved. And it's not to say, you hear some people say, for example, it's the American nightmare, right? And I think there's like a loss of hope in that that we have to set aside and really look more concretely at the types of systems that do help kids and families really experience the kind of social and economic mobility that you and I are talking about. It's not easy. There are playbooks that we have to attend to. We have to like share knowledge and grow our funds of knowledge. My dad would always say to us when I was a kid, we're rich. We're rich because we have a home. We're rich because we have family, because we have community, because we have food on our table. And then if you would have asked me, did you grow up in poverty as a kid? And my answer would have been like, no. I know now that I did, right? Because we lived in Section 8 housing, because there were periods of times when we lived off food stamps or, we're like making it month to month was hard. And yet, I would say, not to speak of it as like this myth of meritocracy that if you just work hard enough that you're just going to get somewhere, but to actually think about the evolution of the American dream, it is one that's less individualistic, one that's less focused on material things and just like capitalism per se, but like what does it mean to actually be rich in terms of health, right? And when we think about the effects of COVID and sort of the post-pandemic era we're living in, there's a lot of strains on the system. Whether that's food security or insecurity that students experience, mental health issues. And so I think that for me, the American dream evolving is really one that's more inclusive, one that attends to our kids' linguistic assets, cultural assets, their race, their ethnicity, and really looks holistically at our children and actually says the promise of America is an opportunity to move forward, to advance, to experience economic and social mobility, to experience educational experiences that, fundamentally focus on student voice and choice within their schools that help them enrich social culturally, and help them be more understanding, more kind, more empathetic human beings. And I think that's the full promise that America brings, and not just this hokey hope, as Dr. Jeff Duncan Andrade talks about. That's like, if you just work hard, you can do this. But actually, there are systemic things that we have to address. And this is the intersection that Dr. Ofelia Garcia talks about between research, policy, and practice, right? And it's the things that we're attending to definitely within our organization to transform the American education system. Something has to give in order for us to live out that promise of America.
Well said. And I really appreciate you bringing in sort of your personal story, and I think it just adds a layer of texture and empathy that draws people in. I hope you don't mind that I talked a little bit about my experience as well.
Of course.
You and this work, kind of wrapping up here, this work is personal for you, and you've said you're kind of an example of what Awella is trying to promote. You talked about that a little bit at the beginning. My question is not so much, although I'd like to hear a little bit about this, sort of what worked for you, but it's more, how can we replicate those experiences to ensure others can use multilingualism as a superpower, as Secretary Cardona has sort of now famously said a while back?
One is definitely to attend to the things we talk about in the opportunity myth, right? To ensure that kids have deep engagement and strong instruction and high expectations those things were the things that were reflected in my educational experience. And it was definitely my first grade teacher, Miss Ivory, who saw me as a native Spanish speaker and was probably like, we need to help this kid learn English, right? And so I would say she was a bridge to me in a lot of ways. The same with Miss Chow, my third grade teacher, who called my parents and said, hey, I think we need to get him tested for gifted and talented. Like between those two teachers and my parents' sacrifices and wherewithal to move to this country and make sure that I had more opportunities. And I think that translates to what we hope to see in the field. Right, that more people see our multilingual learners as an asset, and that there isn't this sort of pobrecito mentality or this like, ah, woe is me. Like, if they just assimilated, right, that things would be easier for them. But actually, that if we help them acculturate and help them see their race, their ethnicity, their culture, their heritage, their language, their home as an asset, and really build bridges between what's happening in schools and what's happening in the communities. I think more kids would experience an authentic educational experience that actually motivates and inspires them. I have a nephew and three nieces, four nieces, and I think a lot about their generation, right? Like the next generation that's coming up and how to help them navigate the schooling experience. And so I think it holds a lot of promise for what's possible. And I would say that that connects very directly to this multilingualism as a superpower because I am not some sort of mythical outlier. More and more, we can see kids like me have the types of opportunities that I've been afforded in a way that is culturally and linguistically affirming and actually attends to all parts of kids' identities.
Yeah, and I would add that is helping many others sort of get there. I mean, the work that you're doing and TNTP doing are doing is obviously super important, and to have somebody with your background experience leading a lot of this work is adds nothing but value to the whole movement that we're trying to create here. So Debbie, as usual, we just scraped the surface of sort of some of the work that you're doing in this topic, which is a broad one. I always say that the sort of purpose of the podcast isn't really, it's not professional development. I don't claim that it is. It is really hopefully to inspire people to take a next step. Maybe they're in their car listening to this or doing dishes or wherever they're doing, and they say, wow, that point that Debbie just made was really interesting. Like, I'm going to take the next step and then figure out where I'm going to go from there. So it leads me to my question, which is a sort of a logistical one. How can people learn more about the work you're doing? They just heard all this about social capital and sort of some ideas you had. Where's the first place that they should go?
Yeah, the TNTP is obviously on all social media platforms. So definitely make sure to follow us on X, on LinkedIn, on Instagram, on Facebook. So that's my plug for work-related things. I tend to share a lot on LinkedIn. That's really been my space in sort of this like post Twitter to X evolution. I've been merging much more towards, connecting with folks on LinkedIn. Also separate, as I mentioned to you, like I do some work on career consulting, career coaching. That's something that's really important and I'm passionate about. And so a friend of mine and I co-founded the Hemp Empowerment Network, which is again, we barely scratched the surface, but on the personal side, like I said, this is something that matters to me. And so we can also be found on all the social media platforms, but I would definitely encourage you also to read the latest report on unlocking learning acceleration for multilingual learners. Our organization has been working on that report for a couple of years now. And so it was exciting to see that come to life, especially last week as we sat beside Montserrat Garibay, Alejandra from the National Newcomer Network, and Ricky Santayana from TEA, where we talked about unlocking funds for multilingual learners, which is like another topic and one that we've collaborated on,
Yes, we
like
have.
funding related to multilingual learners. But I would encourage you to read that report. If you're not familiar with the opportunity myth, definitely encourage you to download that report. It's another foundational text that has really helped advance the field in our thinking about what our kids experience. And there's one question that I ask myself everywhere I go, and that's if the things that we're asking kids to do and engage with are worthy of their time. And we only have so many hours and so many days with kids year over year. And I would say this as a school principal. I was a principal of a kinder through eighth grade school. And I should say, like, our body of work at our school should speak to, a connected experience that if a kid started with us in kindergarten, graduates with us in eighth grade, like we should be able to tell a story about the kinds of experiences that they've had. And we should really, send our kids not just prepared for high school, but prepared for the world. And so the only way we do that is we have things where kids get to engage with that are worthy of their time. Like, let's not waste more of our kids' time. Things like the racial wealth gap are not going to close if we keep wasting kids' time. The promise of multilingualism will not come to fruition if we keep wasting kids' time. So those are the things that I carry with me, and hope that you give us a follow on all the social media platforms, and always down to connect with people on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah, for sure. I will make sure we link to all of those things in the show notes, as well as the blog post that will accompany this episode. And you can always find the blog post at elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity in case you're searching for that. It's hard to get all of these things when you're listening, so those are all available for you in hyperlink format. Last question, Debbie. This is a question that I ask everybody, and it's partially selfish because you can see there's a whole bunch of books behind me, and I get my recommendations from folks on this podcast. But interested to hear if there's a book or film or really any other resource that's had an important influence on you, either personally or professionally, that you want to recommend to listeners.
For sure the film has to be Precious Knowledge, which follows the work of folks in Tucson School District in Arizona, and that transformed me. I was a teacher, dual language teacher, and then became an instructional coach. And that movie in particular really gave me a great sense of what was possible, but also what's at stake and what might even be at risk if we don't sort of really work to unpin some toxic mindsets and beliefs about our kids and our communities. And I'll throw in the bonus, which is not a book, but actually the article from Dr. Jeff Duncan Andrade, Critical Hope. I referenced it, but I would encourage you, if you've not read Dr. Jeff Duncan Andrade's work, that you take a look at that, because I think there's a lot of power in understanding critical hope and what it means. You can look at the world today, right, and like see a lot of doom and gloom and things not progressing fast enough. But if you need sort of a energy boost, I would read his work. And I think we could all benefit from an energy boost in the world and context that we live in today.
Yeah, for sure. Oh man, we will link to those. Debbie, this has been, I talk to a lot of people and I always enjoy the conversations I have. You have a way of expressing things in a very thorough and detailed way, but keeping it very human centric. And I really appreciate that. That's a skill I feel like that is sought after and hard to come by. And you have it. And I would recommend that someday maybe you start your own podcast because I think you'd be really good at it.
Thank you.
And I also say,
Enjoy.
just for the benefit, you may not have gotten the best of me. I said before we started, I very rarely record two podcast episodes in one day, and you got the second one today.
Yeah.
You gave me the energy to kind of make sure that I was sort of staying on my game because what you're talking about is so crucially important. It's a topic we really haven't covered yet on Highest Aspirations. I think it's an important one and one that we need to talk more about for the sake of your family that you referenced and mine, and the idea that that these are things that we need to know about and sort of have in our schools, but in the right ways and in the right formats. And I think you gave us a lot to think about there, and certainly plenty of resources to explore later.
Yeah, we appreciate that. And I think we'd continue to find more similarities, right, in our stories and trajectories. And I think that's the power of this kind of discourse, that we can actually make connections with people and say we're not actually all that different. And the kinds of hopes and dreams that we have for ourselves, for our families, for our kids, for our communities are much more aligned. So appreciate that connection as well.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.